Our episodes deal with serious and often distressing incidents. If you feel at any time you need support, please contact your local crisis centre. For suggested phone numbers for confidential support and for a more detailed list of content warnings, please see the show notes for this episode on your app or on our website. Just before 7 p.m. on Saturday, January 10, 2015, police dispatchers in southeast Texas received an urgent phone call. Their help was desperately needed at the Tomball Regional Medical Center, a 350-bed facility about 30 miles northwest of Houston. Since its establishment in 1976, the hospital has been a cornerstone of healthcare in the region, known for its comprehensive medical services and community-oriented care. While it wasn't unusual for the police to be summoned there to deal with various emergencies and disturbances, this call was markedly different. The caller's voice was calm and efficient, a stark contrast to the incident she was reporting. The situation was volatile, unpredictable, and demanded immediate action, with the caller stating, "We need the police to the hospital, stat." According to the caller, an agitated and intoxicated man had pulled out a 9mm handgun and was threatening staff and visitors. A dozen squad cars rushed to the Tomball Regional Medical Center, their lights flashing and sirens blazing. Officers quickly established a perimeter around the hospital, covering all exit points. Inside the hospital, staff had already sprung into action, initiating their own emergency response procedures. Security personnel had called for a total lockdown, while nurses and doctors worked together to ensure the safety of their patients. The gunman was on the second floor, in a private room in the intensive care unit. Patients in nearby rooms were moved to safer areas on other floors, while visitors were swiftly but calmly escorted out of the building. The typical bustle of the second floor corridors was replaced by an eerie quiet. At the main entrance, staff set up a triage area for incoming emergencies, diverting ambulances to other facilities in the area. The hospital's public relations team fielded calls from local media, providing what little information they could while trying to remain calm. The administration staff converted a conference room into an impromptu command center, coordinating with law enforcement and monitoring the situation throughout the building. News filtered through that the gunman had two, maybe three, hostages with him. This scenario was beyond the scope of the local police and required specialized backup. The county sheriff's office's high-risk operation unit, more commonly referred to as a SWAT team, was deployed to the scene. The SWAT team's arrival marked an escalation in the unfolding chaos. Officers emerged from their vehicles heavily armed with weapons and specialized equipment, taking various positions around the hospital. As more details trickled in, they realized they weren't dealing with a random act of violence. The situation was far more complex than they initially thought. Two days earlier, at 3 a.m. on Thursday, January 8, 2015, 911 operators received a frantic call from a woman named Teresa Pickering. Her son, 27-year-old George Pickering III, was having a major seizure. This wasn't entirely out of the ordinary for George. He had a history of seizures and medical complications which had resulted in various hospital stays throughout his life, and it was part of the reason he remained living at home with his mother. But this time was different. When paramedics arrived at the Pickerings' home, George was unresponsive. They rushed him to the Tomball Regional Medical Centre, where he was taken straight in for a computed tomography scan, more commonly referred to as a CT scan, on his brain. Doctors discovered that George had a dangerous buildup of valproic acid in his system, which was caused by his anti-seizure medication. He was diagnosed with valproic toxicity, and his condition was deemed critical. As dawn broke over Tomball, the medical team worked tirelessly to do what they could for George. But 3 hours later, his condition was deteriorating. Doctors made the decision to intubate the comatose George, inserting a tube into his airway to help him breathe. George's mother, Teresa, and his brother, Brandon, stayed by his bed, praying he would wake up. They took turns holding George's hand and talking to him as a stream of nurses and doctors came and went from the room. Later that morning, Brandon called his father, who was estranged from Teresa and didn't live with the rest of the family, and relayed the information that George had had a catastrophic stroke and was on life support. The attending physician, Dr. Adrian Santamaria, gravely advised Teresa that George's neurological exam painted a bleak and complex picture. While George was intubated and sedated, his brainstem appeared to be intact and he was still responding to pain stimuli. The brainstem, often referred to as the body's control center, is responsible for many vital functions, including breathing, heart rate, and blood pressure. A functioning brainstem and response to pain are significant indicators of neurological activity. However, the stroke George had suffered was catastrophic, and the doctor's prognosis was pessimistic. In cases like this, medical staff have a fine line to tread. They must balance the need for accurate medical assessment with the emotional needs of the family. Hospitals have a duty to provide clear, honest information about a patient's condition, no matter how difficult that information might be to deliver or receive. This responsibility is a cornerstone of medical ethics, ensuring that families can make informed decisions about their loved one's care. The doctors didn't think George was likely to emerge from his coma, and they didn't want to provide his mother with false hopes. As Friday, January 9 dawned, George's condition remained unchanged. Dr. Adrian Santamaria, along with other medical professionals, began the heart-wrenching task of explaining to the Pickering family that George had extensive cerebral infarction. In other words, widespread death of brain tissue. The medical team told the Pickerings that George's poor neurological prognosis meant he was in a vegetative state from which he was unlikely to recover. Teresa Pickering was George's primary caregiver and medical proxy, which meant it was up to her to make decisions on his behalf if he was unable to communicate those himself. For Teresa, each piece of information she received about her son's condition was another blow. Both she and her son Brandon were exhausted, physically and emotionally. They were struggling to deal with all the medical jargon, grim prognoses, and life-altering decisions thrust their way. Then, at around lunchtime, a case manager met with Teresa and gently provided her with a list of funeral homes and crematories, a necessary but brutal reminder of the potential outcome they were facing. George's doctors also wanted to know whether he had ever expressed any wishes about extending life support if he was ever in a situation such as this. They then asked whether he was an organ donor. This was a standard question to ask for a prognosis of this kind, yet Teresa and Brandon were overwhelmed by the weight of making such decisions on George's behalf. Trying to decide what to do was making an already devastating situation even more of a struggle. That evening, a nurse from Tombaugh Regional Medical Centre quietly contacted LifeGift, a non-profit organ procurement organisation, alerting them that the hospital had a comatose patient who was a potential organ donor. For organisations like LifeGift, the opportunity to receive organs from a young, otherwise healthy individual is incredibly valuable. Their organs are typically in better condition and can function effectively for longer periods in recipients, potentially saving or improving multiple lives. A few hours later, at around midnight, that same nurse informed LifeGift that George Pickering appeared to be brain dead. Brain death is a technical medical term. It refers to the irreversible loss of all functions of the brain, including the brainstem. Key aspects of brain death include no electrical activity in the brain, loss of all brainstem reflexes, and inability to breathe independently. In many jurisdictions, this condition is legally and medically recognized as death. George's updated condition triggered a sense of urgency among the organ procurement team, as the window for harvesting viable organs is limited once brain death occurs. At 3 a.m, a representative from LifeGift attended the hospital and met with medical staff and George's family to discuss the next steps. Dr. Adrian Santamaria told Teresa there was a small window for George to pass peacefully, rather than recovering and remaining in an altered mental state with no quality of life. While the medical team continued to emphasise how poor George's prognosis was, his family found themselves grappling with complex ethical and emotional questions. How could they make a decision about George's body while still hoping against hope for a miracle? Two days into the ordeal, on Saturday, January 10, 2015, Teresa and Brandon Pickering made a heartbreaking decision. Comforted only by their belief that it would have been what George would have wanted, they consented to have his ventilator removed. The hospital staff began preparations for what's known as a terminal wean. This is the process of gradually and humanely removing life support from a patient. With George set to donate his organs, the small silver lining in the tragedy was that his death might give life to others in need. Brandon Pickering called his father, 59-year-old George Pickering II, and told him to come and see his son one last time before he died. Even though they didn't live together, George Jr. and his father were close. Not only did they share a name, they looked alike, with matching builds, gait, and hairlines. George Jr. had followed in his father's footsteps by joining the Boy Scouts, and the two had worked together from time to time running a small electrical engineering business. George Jr. had even helped his father build his home. When George Jr. was admitted to hospital, George Sr. was going through a rough patch. He was unemployed and living in Pinehurst, a nearby rural town of around 5,000 people. He also struggled with a drinking problem. By the time Brandon reached out to him to let him know that George Jr.'s life support was going to be turned off, George Sr. was already inebriated. This was a worrying sign given the gravity of the situation, as George Sr. had a history of becoming confrontational when drinking. The news hit George Pickering II hard. For years, he'd watched his son battle seizures and endure countless hospital visits. The possibility that he had finally succumbed to a catastrophic health event was too much to bear. That evening, George Sr. arrived at the Tombaugh Regional Medical Centre and stormed into his son's room. Intoxicated and belligerent, he demanded to have time alone with George Jr. He also insisted that he be part of the decision-making process when it came to removing his life support. Hospital staff, bound by ethical guidelines and legal constraints, found themselves in the position of having to manage not only a critical patient, but also a distraught and potentially dangerous family member. Their primary duty was to their patient, George Jr., but they also had to consider the safety of other patients, visitors, and staff. While the decision to deny George Sr.'s demands was medically and ethically sound, it only served to exacerbate an already volatile situation. Denied of his requests, George Sr. suddenly pulled a 9mm pistol from his waistband and pointed it at the nurse standing between him and his son. He began waving the pistol around erratically, demanding that the nurse leave the room along with Teresa and Brandon. George Sr. said he planned to die with his son. In the chaos that followed, Brandon managed to wrestle the gun away from his distraught father. But the situation was far from diffused. "I was a Boy Scout," George Sr. shouted. "You don't think that's the only weapon I have?" He then barricaded himself in the room and yelled, "I'll kill all of you all." He pulled the curtain around himself and George Jr., blocking the view so that nobody could see where he was or whether he was still armed, ready to attack anyone who tried to take his son off life support. As the situation escalated, the hospital transformed into the scene of a standoff. The arrival of law enforcement, culminating in the deployment of a SWAT team, underscored the severity of the crisis. The doctor told the SWAT team that George Jr. had no cortical function and no hope of meaningful recovery. This prognosis only highlighted the cruel irony of the situation. A father's refusal to accept medical expertise was now endangering lives in a place dedicated to saving them. There was also confusion as to whether George Sr. had another weapon or any hostages besides his comatose son. Police made inquiries that confirmed George Sr. had licenses for numerous handguns. As hostage negotiation experts formulated a plan, the hospital staff found themselves serving dual roles, continuing to provide medical care for their patients while also calmly managing a security threat. Tensions ran high as patients who were already dealing with their own health concerns faced the additional stress of a dangerous conflict happening in their vicinity. Members of the SWAT team strategically placed themselves on the now empty second floor and outside of the room where George Jr. and his father remained concealed by a curtain. They tried to negotiate with George Sr., but he was hostile and largely incoherent. The only thing that was clear was that he didn't want his son taken off life support. Outside, the gathering media trained their cameras on the second floor window, the different networks all vying for the prime position to capture any drama that might unfold. As the standoff stretched into its third hour, the tactical response unit requisitioned a remote-controlled robot. Their strategy involved deploying the robot to infiltrate the room and to draw back the privacy curtain, allowing the operatives to maintain a safe distance. Behind that curtain, George Sr. refused to accept his son's prognosis. George Jr. had been in a similar situation before, but he was resilient and had pulled through in the end. Something deep in George Sr.'s gut pierced his drunken fog and told him that his son still had a chance. He felt the doctors were moving too fast, that they weren't giving his son enough time to fight. He held on to George Jr., praying and begging for him to squeeze his hand or provide some other sign that he knew his father was with him. "Squeeze my hand," he sobbed. "Squeeze my hand." And George Jr. squeezed. George Pickering Sr. wasn't sure whether the moment had really happened or if he'd hallucinated it in his desperate, drunken state. he repeated his request. Squeeze my hand. George Jr. squeezed again, and then a third time after that. Realizing that his desperate gambit had bought his son some extra time to fight for his life, George Sr. sagged to the ground. He sought an assurance from the doctors stationed outside the door that George Jr.'s life support would not be turned off, and then called out that he was ready to give himself up. At 10:45 p.m., over 3.5 hours into the standoff, the SWAT team's robot pulled back the curtain, and George Pickering Sr. surrendered peacefully. Rather than being taken straight to jail, he was put into a bed in the same hospital where his son remained on life support. 15 minutes later, a nurse entered George Jr.'s room. George's eyes flooded open and he tracked the nurse's movements. The nurse then took his hand and asked him to squeeze it. Once again, George squeezed. The young man, who hours earlier had been described as having no hope of recovery, was awake and responsive. The resolution of the standoff brought a wave of relief to the besieged hospital and made national headlines. The story captured public attention, sparking intense debate about medical ethics, parental rights, and the complexities of end-of-life care. Many people, while disapproving of George Pickering Sr.'s methods, understood and sympathised with his motivations. Speaking to the media, a Tomball police sergeant stated, "It's a very sad situation when you have someone in the hospital and they're ill and you're afraid of losing somebody." George Pickering Sr. was very distraught. As you well know, people handle stress differently. You never can say what it will take to hit such a serious trigger mechanism. He was wanting the best and for the doctors and nurses to pay more attention. My guess would be he let his emotions kick in, and it's a sad situation, and he allowed his emotions to cause him to make a bad decision. In the quiet streets of Pinehurst, neighbours grappled with the news. While not condoning George Sr.'s actions, many rallied around the Pickering family. Pondering the unthinkable scenario of losing a child, one resident asked reporters, "How do you not be distraught when your son has a major stroke and the hospital tells you there's not much they can do, that they're going to pull the plug? How would you feel? I'd want to go beat some doctors' heads with my fists. Wouldn't you?" George Pickering Sr. was discharged from the hospital and transferred to jail. He was quickly released on a $30,000 bond, facing charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. He remained steadfast in his conviction that he would do it all again, declaring, "If I'm guilty of anything, it's of loving my son too much." In the weeks that followed, contrary to all medical expectations, George Pickering Jr. began to make a recovery. It started with small responsive movements before progressing to signs of consciousness. Eventually, George Jr. had full awareness. While his recovery was celebrated as miraculous by his family, it also raised serious questions about the initial prognosis and the rush to make end-of-life decisions. The presence of toxic levels of anti-seizure medication in George's system at the time of his admission came under intense scrutiny. Medical experts pointed out that such high levels of medication can suppress brain activity, potentially masking signs of life and complicating the diagnosis of brain death. This revelation cast a shadow over the hospital's initial assessment and the speed with which end-of-life options were presented to the family. It wasn't until several weeks after the incident that George's family thought he was strong enough to handle the news about what had happened while he was in his coma. George embarked on a challenging journey of rehabilitation involving intense physical therapy and ongoing medical treatments. Meanwhile, his father faced his own battles. Not only was George Pickering Sr. still struggling with his alcoholism, because he'd been charged with violent offences that included threatening his ex-wife and son, a no-contact order had been imposed on him while he was awaiting trial. This meant he wasn't allowed to see Teresa, Brandon, or George Jr. George Jr. was released from hospital in late March 2015, roughly 2.5 months after he was first admitted in a critical condition. On Easter Sunday, he accepted an invitation from his father for them to get baptized together at their local church. It was a symbol of their shared journey and transition into a new life. However, the baptism landed George Sr. in trouble as it was a violation of his no-contact order. His bail was subsequently revoked and he was sent to jail to await trial on the aggravated assault charges arising from the incident. George Sr. found solace in knowing that his desperate actions had given his son the chance he needed. While the months behind bars were difficult, he never once regretted the choice he'd made. By December 2015, nearly a year had passed since that fateful night in the hospital, and George Pickering Sr. finally had his day in court. One charge was dropped and the other was reduced to a state jail felony. He was given credit for the time he'd already served and he was released in time to spend Christmas with the son he'd almost lost. The news crews were there for his homecoming and the father and son sat down for an interview with local TV station KPRC2. Reflecting on their extraordinary experience, George Sr. remained convinced that divine intervention was to thank. "I believe, and I'll always believe, that there was a miracle that took place that night," he stated. The Pickerings' story touched hearts across the country. Their tale was presented as the power of a parent's love and the thin line between right and wrong in desperate situations. George's defense attorney remarked, "This case has always been about a father protecting his son when his son couldn't protect himself." The Pickerings case served as a stark reminder of the complexity surrounding end-of-life care and the profound impact these decisions have on patients and their families. While no one condoned George Sr.'s actions, many came to understand the desperate love that drove him to that point. When asked for a response, officials at Tomball Regional Medical Center explained they were unable to comment about individual patients due to strict privacy laws. However, they provided a statement that read, "Physicians use their medical knowledge and experience to develop a patient's plan of care, and these actions save lives each day. When a patient's condition makes them unable to participate in their own care, the appropriate substitute decision maker has the right to decide whether or not they will move forward with a recommended care plan. However, that decision must be expressed in a way that does not endanger other patients or caregivers." George Sr.'s actions have been widely debated. Some individuals opposed to organ donation and termination of life support have co-opted his story to further their own agenda. Meanwhile, physicians have pointed to the incident as a cautionary tale against misinformation and the hazards they face in their workplace. George Jr. and Sr. filed a lawsuit against the Tomball Regional Medical Center as well as Dr. Adrian Santamaria. Ultimately, the court ruled in favor of the hospital. It was stated that the nurse should not have used the term brain dead to describe George's condition, as Dr. Santamaria had never made this diagnosis. The legal outcome, while providing closure for the hospital, did little to diminish the impact of the Pickering story on public consciousness. By this time, George Jr. was well on the way to a full recovery, for which he thanked his dad. In the interview with KPRC2, the father and son sat side by side, with George Jr. remarking, "Everything good that made me a man is because of that man sitting next to me. It's the duty of a parent to protect your children, and that's all he did. The important thing is I'm alive and well, my father is home, and we're together again. There was a law broken, but it was broken for all the right reasons. I'm here now because of it. It was love. It was love."